Welcome to Side Streets, a podcast about the history and geography of London. I'm Alan Hertz, Professor Emeritus of Humanities at Hult International Business School. Despite my accent, I've been prowling London and learning about its past for over 40 years. Side Streets is a Black Lab media production, and my producer and editor is Wilhelm Schenk. This time, we're going back further than usual, back to London's beginnings. This is Season 2's fifth episode, Founding Londinia. I grew up around two great cities, New York and Karachi, and they formed my intuitive sense of what a city should be. In some obvious ways, they could not be more different, but in others, they are surprisingly similar. Both are great ports. They flourished by providing a rich hinterland with access to the world. And both are great ports because they have truly magnificent harbors. I arrived in London with a presumption that a successful trading city would be located where a navigable river meets the sea in a grand, sheltered anchorage. I knew that London had been such a city, at its peak the busiest in the world. The river was easy to find, the hinterland was certainly rich, but where was the harbor? Where was the sea? This episode is not an attempt to answer those questions. Rather, it is a recognition that they depend on dubious assumptions, that my model of a commercial city was too limited, that London is not New York or Karachi, maybe it is more like Rome. And that should not be a surprise, since London was founded not by New Yorkers, but by Romans. Before the Romans returned to Britain in the first century AD, there was no real urban life here. The chiefs who controlled regions of the island had centers of power, but they were more like fortresses than towns, and they were located at places which could be easily defended and which controlled important territory. That is, good places for fortresses. The Romans took most of those places over and turned them into cities, with grids of streets, central marketplaces, temples, bathhouses, bureaucrats, and other important features of civilization. But they did this at least in part, because in their view, they were bringing civilization to people who did not have it, since to them, civilization, our word still implies this, was inherently urban. But London was different. The Romans called it Londinium, so when I speak about their city, I will too. Archaeologists do not completely agree about whether there had ever been a significant human presence, a town of some kind, here before the Romans, but they do agree that no such settlement was here when the Romans arrived. In other places, Camulodunum or Verulamium, they were working with local people to transform existing settlements. When they founded Londinium, they were starting from scratch. Let's consider why there was nothing much here. After all, the Thames is the most significant geographical feature in the south of England. To anyone living along it, the river could be an enormous asset, a trade route, a source of water and food, a ready-made waste disposal system. But when England is politically fragmented, as it was when the Romans arrived, the Thames is also a natural border. And if the neighbors are unfriendly, living on the border may be insecure, even unsafe. So when they established a settlement by the river, the Romans were announcing and acknowledging a new regime, one in which Britannia was unified, peaceful, and dare I say it, civilized. Londinium was an imperial city. We can take this a stage further. When traders in Britain looked to the south for trading partners, as they did during the Roman period, the southeast corner of Britain will be in prime position, and the Thames Valley, facing the mouth of the Rhine across only a narrow stretch of open sea, will be an ideal commercial base. When British traders looked north, as they did in Viking times, or west, as they did during the mercantile 18th century, London's geographical leverage is much reduced. One of the most interesting stories in London's history is how it maintained its preeminent position among British cities, even when geography favored other places. Maybe I'll discuss that in a future episode, but now let's get back to the Romans. Recent archaeological investigations have found the earliest evidence yet of Roman occupation, On the slope above the north bank of the Thames, by the Walbrook, the stream that once divided the city of London in half. What they uncovered seems to be the remains of a military camp from the period immediately after the second conquest of 42 AD, and that makes sense. The campaigning army needed a supply depot, and this spot would have been ideal. The Thames was narrow here, with islands on the south side making a pontoon or temporary bridge feasible. Ships could come up the river and unload here, and roads to get supplies to the front line could radiate out from the bridgehead. So maybe, before it was anything else, Londinium was an army base. That origin story seems plausible, but we should be cautious. Let me digress to explain why. Historical evidence seems to come in only two quantities, much too much and much too little. A good example of the first is my own favorite moment, Britain, in 1859. I used to teach a whole course on it. I'm not diligent, but no one, no matter how diligent, could ever find, let alone evaluate and absorb, more than a tiny fraction of the evidence for what Britain was like in 1859. The newspapers, magazines, books, letters, the surviving clothes and furniture and other stuff, the mountainous quantity of available primary source material is overwhelming. Historians trying to make sense of that moment must be ruthlessly selective. They must assume that the millions of words and things they do not consult would simply corroborate the conclusions they reach from the handful that they do. But the second Roman invasion of Britain is very different. We have no contemporary documentary evidence at all, and the material evidence from archaeology is fragmentary and scanty. What we know depends in large part on what places have been available for excavation when time, money, and expertise could be found to excavate them. Historians have very little data to work with, and what they have has been uncovered by chance, not because it was sought out as likely to be helpful or authoritative. So enormous weight is placed on every scrap. New technologies of analysis have transformed archaeology in the past few decades. Now each piece of evidence can tell us much more than before, but when a new bit appears, there's a good chance that previous speculations will have to be revised. So Londinium began as a military base. That's our best guess for now, until the next big construction project creates another opportunity for archaeologists to find something which contradicts it. As the Romans extended their control over Britain, that stretch of riverbank developed from a supply base into a commercial and bureaucratic center. This too makes sense. The roads radiating out from the bridge were as useful for trade as they were for military logistics. The local Thames tributaries, the fleet, and the Walbrook could power industry, flour mills, for example, and provide water for drinking and bathing. And the Thames, this must have startled the Romans, was tidal, almost to Londinium. So ships could surf in on the incoming tide, then surf out again. They could reach the town easily and load and unload while protected from coastal storms and raiders. Pioneers and entrepreneurs looking to exploit the economic opportunities of the new province naturally came to Londinium, and they found opportunities for profit. The army continued to need supplies for more established parts of the empire. The native population developed a taste for the goods that trade could provide, and the empire developed a taste for British goods as well. In Londinium, there were no pesky locals to placate or compete with. Perfect. What turned out to be imperfect was not Londinium's location or commercial potential, but imperial control over the new territory. Pax Romana was not so peaceful after all. Undoubtedly, the best-known episode in the 3.5 centuries of the Roman period happened less than 20 years in. Boudica, queen of the Iceni, led an uprising which killed thousands and obliterated 3 new Roman towns. The last of those was Londinium, and it seems to have been Boudica's primary target. Maybe this makes sense, too. Londinium was probably already the largest settlement in Britain, with perhaps 10,000 inhabitants. It also had a distinctive and alien culture, using types of pottery, for example, not found elsewhere in Britain at this time. Founded and inhabited by outsiders, emblematic of imperial rule, with foreign fashions in cooking and dress, Londinium must have been a peculiarly alien and offensive intrusion to the rebels. Their response was devastating. Archaeologists refer to Boudiccan ash, the layer of burnt material they find at the bottom of any excavation of early Roman Londinium. So almost as soon as it was established, Londinium had to be completely recreated and repopulated. The Romans didn't just found it once, they did it twice. The rebuilding of Londinium after the revolt did not start immediately. New administrators were appointed and took some time to arrive. Britain was a long way from the center of power, and that isolation did much to shape Roman rule throughout their time here. But when reconstruction began, Londinium was first in the queue, ahead of the other destroyed settlements. Not everything was rebuilt, and the population may well have been significantly smaller at first. Understandably, that population felt insecure. One of the first building projects was defensive earthworks to the north of the town. But business was brisk. The port was rebuilt larger than before, with wharves extending into the river, cranes for loading and unloading ships, and a stone warehouse complex. The use of stone is interesting, since there are no local quarries. It must have been important for these warehouses to be secure and fireproof. For reasons I don't quite understand, this new port was upstream from the bridge, which must have had some kind of drawbridge to enable seagoing ships to use it. Bathhouses and the extensive and sophisticated apparatus needed to bring them water were also created in the first few years. Throughout the Roman period, they were a high priority, and the largest, the complex located where Cannon Street Station is now, was much bigger than any temple found so far. It was so grand that the archaeologists who first excavated it thought they had discovered the residence of the Roman provincial governor. The early construction of these bathing facilities is evidence of their importance to Roman social and cultural life. It is also evidence of how Roman this city was. When Vespasian became emperor in 70 AD, construction in London boomed. He had served in the army here, so perhaps he had a special interest in Britain. That may have led him to commission and fund large public works, or may have led local officials to curry favor with him by doing so. Whatever the reason, over the next decade, Londinium began to acquire the impressive civic geography and buildings that graced other Roman provincial cities. The distinctive rectangular street grid of Roman towns was expanded. New port facilities appeared downstream from the bridge. A grand brick structure was built on the south side of the river. The experts think that this was an administrative center with offices and accommodation for bureaucrats and important imperial visitors. One of the deepest patterns in London's history is a geographical division between economic and political power. In later times, the former was in the city, the latter upstream in Westminster. Perhaps here we have that pattern appearing for the first time. Administrative power wielded in Southwark, commerce and manufacture bustling away in Londinium. Something even more spectacular was going up on the northern edge of the city, Londinium's amphitheater. At its heart was a large gravel-covered performance space. Around it were timber grandstands seating roughly 7,000 people, perhaps half the adult population at the time. The whole was surrounded by a wooden enclosure, which would later be rebuilt in stone. Vespasian was responsible for the Colosseum in Rome itself, and structures of this kind were important not only for sporting events, but also for celebrations of the imperial cult. So this is, among other things, an emphatic public statement. Londinium is an enthusiastic participant in a completely un-British civilization. Londinium's first forum, the center of municipal public life, was also built at this time. It was a large rectangular structure at the top of the street running north from the bridge. There was an open central marketplace with arcades of shops and offices around three sides, and impressive courtrooms and religious spaces on the north. It soon became the heart of a new district of luxurious private homes, temples, and bathhouses. This kind of structure was previously completely unknown in Britain, and like the amphitheater and the bathhouses, embodied a completely alien notion of community life. With its construction, Londinium had completed the transition from no man's land to camp to city. Maybe that's a good place to pause for reflection. From the start, Londinium was a foreign city on British soil. It was established by invaders to supply and secure their conquest. It was populated by foreigners who came to supply the conquering army and their collaborators with imported goods. Its landmarks were buildings of a type never seen in Britain before, with alien purposes built in an alien style. Its location may be intentionally reminiscent of Rome, inland, on hills, at a point where a navigable river can be bridged. The hostility of locals to this intrusion is understandable, but much of what we understand as British in later times is a legacy not of their lost culture, but of the civilization the Romans brought to Britain. London may not have seemed British 2,000 years ago, but much of what seemed foreign then is at the heart of Britishness now. We will explore that idea in more detail next time. Well, that's enough for now. Next time, we will try to discover what daily life was like in Londinium. Those eager for more can subscribe on Patreon and wander down another alleyway, my meditation on the statue of Boudicca and her daughters on Victoria Embankment. This episode was researched, written, and presented by me, Alan Hertz. Side Streets is a Black Lab Media production, and my producer and editor is Wilhelm Schenk.